All right, not yet. Okay. Please ask lots of questions. It'll keep us all awake. Okay, so last time we did some examples of manifolds with metrics. We looked at a sphere in ordinary spherical polar coordinates. We looked at a sphere in stereographic coordinates. And I just wanted to mention there's an interesting theorem, which if you're curious, you might want to follow up. And it was discovered by an interesting person, John Nash, who you might know as the character in a certain film called A Beautiful Mind. And what Nash discovered, and it's one of the hardest theorems to prove in differential geometry, so I have no idea how he proved it, but what he proved is that every Riemannian manifold, okay, so remember, Riemannian manifold means a topological space, a space of points, which you can label with some coordinates, and then you have to have a metric on the space, and the main property of the metric is that it's possible to choose coordinates at any point such that the metric locally looks flat, looks like. And if it's Riemannian, that flat means delta mu nu. The metric is just the matrix delta mu nu. Ones on the diagonal, zero everywhere else. So every Riemannian manifold can be isometrically embedded in a Euclidean space of some dimension. Okay? So tell me what isometrically means. Pardon? Preserved length isometrically. What is it, what do you think it means? So I'm embedding this manifold inside a Euclidean space. So it should be specified, for example, by some equation that tells you where it is in that space, like the equation for a sphere, x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1. So you can think about it as a higher dimensional curve in that space. And when I say isometrically, what do I mean? I gave you a manifold with a metric.
So the metric is preserved.
What does that mean, preserved?
Fall back with the metric, but from the embedding is the same.
Yeah, exactly. So the metric you would have gotten by taking the Euclidean metric in this space and restricting it to the manifold, just like we did with the sphere. We restricted to the manifold by imposing x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1. When you restrict the metric to the manifold, then you get the same manifold. You get the same metric. Okay, so that's interesting that you can do it. And in particular, so for pseudo-Riemannian manifold, well, let me just say it this way. You might be interested in a four-dimensional manifold, 4D manifold, can be locally embedded in 10 Euclidean dimensions. Okay, so that's the particular case of four dimensions. And many people have puzzled about the coincidence that the four dimensions here and the 10 dimensions of string theory might be related, but nobody's ever found out how to make sense of that relation. Let's do an example. Not working. 4D de Sitter spacetime. So this is a particularly interesting spacetime because it's the simplest one you can write down in four dimensions with one time and three space directions. And it's also interesting because it happens to be the spacetime we seem to be evolving towards. Okay, so we live in an expanding universe, as we'll discuss later. The universe is dominated by dark energy. This dark energy has the property that it does not get diluted away by the expansion of the universe. It just remains at fixed density. Everything else is diluting away, the galaxies, the radiation, stars, matter, but the dark energy takes over, and the solution which we are tending towards is one of just Einstein gravity plus dark energy. And that solution is called De Sitter spacetime. And basically, it's the four-dimensional version of a sphere. It's a space with the greatest possible symmetry, which is a solution of the Einstein equations. So I'll tell you what this... So De Sitter spacetime was discovered long before the observations. And it's a pretty amazing fact that our universe happens to be heading towards the simplest, the most symmetrical possible spacetime. And it happens to be the most symmetrical possible one with positive, small positive energy density contributed by the dark energy. So what is De Sitter spacetime? Well, it's just like a sphere. This is a, let's say it's a 3+1 dimensional, three space, one time. Dimensional version of a sphere. And as you might imagine, a sphere is the most symmetrical manifold you can have. And we are heading towards this very symmetrical universe for reasons which are still mysterious. So let me tell you what it is. So imagine a five-dimensional Minkowski space. Yeah. With the metric eta AB. Okay, so eta AB, this is the matrix minus 1, 1, 1, 1. These A and B go from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. And so we can write the distance squared, or what we call the line element, okay, which is just eta AB dx. And these are capital X's. The coordinates on the five-dimensional Minkowski space are capital X's. And so this one, this is minus dx naught squared plus dx1 squared plus dot, 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 plus dx4 squared. So let's take that five-dimensional space and consider a hyperboloid embedded in that space, a 4D hyperboloid. So a hyperboloid is like a sphere specified by a quadratic equation, but with one minus sign. So four-dimensional hyperboloid will be minus x naught squared plus x1 squared plus x2 squared. X2 squared plus dot, 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 X4 squared equals L squared. Okay, so this is some fixed length. And if I want to sketch that hyperboloid, it basically looks like this. Here is X0. there is x1. If I set all the other x's to 0, the x2 to 4, then the equation is just that x1 squared is x0 squared plus l squared. And so that looks like this, where this distance is l, and this curve here is x1 squared is x0 squared plus l squared. And likewise over here. So there's my hyperboloid. It asymptotically tends to these straight lines, x0 equals x1. And of course, when I include the other coordinates, it's just a surface of revolution. Okay, so this hyperboloid looks something like this. And that space here is de Sitter spacetime. Okay? So now, the one thing you have to be careful about in looking at a picture like this is that it's embedded in Minkowski spacetime. Okay, so just keep in mind that the x naught direction is not an ordinary space direction. It's a Minkowski direction. But what you can see in that picture is basically de Sitter spacetime is a bouncing universe, right? If I think about this at constant time, means constant x naught. So when x naught is minus infinity, it's a big sphere. Right? X1 squared plus X2 squared plus X3 squared plus X4 squared equals L squared plus X0 squared. So it's basically this huge sphere, huge three-dimensional sphere in the past. And then it comes in, and at time equals 0, X0 equals 0, it's a small sphere of radius L. And at time goes to n plus infinity, it's a big sphere again. So this is a bouncing universe. It's the simplest example of a bouncing universe. And as I said, it happens to be a solution of the Einstein equations with a vacuum energy. Now, what we did with the sphere is we solved that constraint, the quadratic equation in the x's, in terms of one fewer coordinate. And then we used the line element to figure out the metric. So let's do the same thing again. So we'll solve the constraint by setting x naught equals to. So how do, if I've got, just imagine two numbers, x naught and x1. And I want to change variables from x naught and x1 to some other variables such that that equation is automatically true. So you're looking for some functions such that minus the square of the first plus the square of the second is always a constant. Cos and sinh, very good. So x naught, we say, is equal to L sinh t, right? And x1 will be L cosh t. And then I want to treat all of these four coordinates equally. And basically, as I said, they all parameterize a sphere, a three-dimensional sphere, okay, of a certain radius. So let's just use the usual angles on the sphere. So this one would be sine theta. It's a three-dimensional sphere, actually. So yeah, let me do it this way. You just think what's most convenient. I tell you what, let me write it this way. Omega I, okay, where let me use capital I, okay, y I equals 1 to 4. And what I want is that these omega I should be 1. and they should depend on three parameters. Okay, and so basically these are the polar angles on a three sphere. And so you can write omega I as equal to sine chi, and then the usual, so it's like the two sphere, but they're three coordinates. So sine chi, sine theta, cos phi, sine chi, sine theta, sine phi, sine chi, cos theta, and cos chi. Okay? So is that clear? The sum of the squares of all these things are 1, because all I did is I put cosine and sine here. So these two squared gives me this sine squared, but this one will give me sine squared. So sine squared plus cos squared gives me 1, and then sine squared plus cos squared gives me 1. So this omega parameterizes a three sphere. Okay, and then the line element becomes, so just make this substitution, and what you'll find is minus dt squared plus cos squared. I've got an L squared out the front, because the line element is just quadratic in the x's, and the L is just a constant. So times this, cos squared t, and then d omega 3 squared, where d omega 3 squared, and this is just going to be d chi squared plus sine squared chi d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared is the metric on S3. Okay, so we've discovered the space-time metric on de Sitter space. And as I explained, it's just a bouncing universe. At constant t, this little t time, the size of your three sphere is given by this cosh factor. And cosh, as you know, bounces, has a minimum at t equals 0, and it blows up either way. And so that's the metric on de Sitter space-time. And this is one of the this is probably the most intriguing and puzzling space-time in general relativity for physical reasons, that we're heading towards it. You can ask, you know, what is this scale? How big is this de Sitter space-time? The scale is about the Hubble radius today. So it's about 9 billion light years. You can see from this metric that as t goes forward to the future, actually the space-time expands exponentially. So the space is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's more and more and more volume. The energy density is remaining the same. The dark energy density is remaining the same. So it's a very peculiar and puzzling space-time. And people worry about it a lot, what it means, that this is our future. I wanted to show you that de Sitter space-time can actually be represented in many ways. The way I've just done is as a closed universe. Okay, this is a closed universe. It's a three-sphere. Closed means it doesn't have any boundary. So space has no boundary. The space-time has a boundary. Space-time has two boundaries, in fact. It has one out here at minus infinity and at one up here at plus infinity. Okay, these are the boundaries, but there's no boundary at finite. There's no boundary for space. Now, that's the closed slicing. Okay, and so I could slice it here as well. But if you look at the space-time, there's nothing to stop you from slicing it some other way, okay? And especially if you think about it being embedded in a Minkowski space, right? There are actually three natural slicings in Minkowski space. Can you tell me what they are? So here I've picked a slicing whose normal is time-like. Yeah. You could take a light cone. Why don't we pick a direction? This direction is space-like, right? In the Minkowski's direction. Why don't we pick a light-like direction? That's a completely natural thing to do in Minkowski space. Or what else could I do?
Time-like.
Time-like, yeah? So I could actually slice it on null planes, like that. That's an interesting thing to do, right? So this would be the null slicing, okay? Or I could use a vertical slicing, okay, and slice it like this, time-like slicing, okay? So it turns out that if you slice it this way, it looks like a closed universe that bounces. Slice it this way, it'll look like a flat universe, okay, spatially flat universe. I'll show you that in a second. And if you slice it this way, it looks like a spatially open universe, meaning that the spatial slices are three-dimensional hyperboloids, okay? Meaning that you can think of that, it's like the three-sphere is embedded in four Euclidean dimensions with an equation x1 squared x4 squared equals 1. That would be a three-sphere. But I can also embed in four-dimensional Minkowski space and put a minus sign in front of them, one of these things, and I'll get a hyperbolic space. So so this one gives you a flat universe, flat 3D universe, and this one gives you a open, meaning hyperbolic, 3D universe. So I'm just going to show you the flat version of De Sitter space, the flat slicing of De Sitter space. And so let's see how that works. The formulae look a bit horrible at first, but I'll kind of explain the logic behind them. So X naught you replace by L sinh t plus 1/2 r squared e to the t. Okay, so it's a little bit like the closed slicing, but you have this correction term. Xi equals L e to the t little xi. I equals 1 to 3. And then you have x4 equals L cosh t minus 1/2 r squared e to the t. And r squared is equal to xi xi, just as usual. Okay, and then I'll leave it as an exercise for you to show that minus dx naught squared plus dx 1 squared plus dot 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 plus dx 4 squared, x 4 squared, is equal to L squared minus dt squared plus e to the 2t dxi dxi. Okay, amazingly simple answer, that when you slice De Sitter on null slices, the metric is absolutely flat in the spatial direction, just a flat 3D space. Okay, so this is Euclidean three-dimensional space with a flat metric. and it expands exponentially in T. Okay, but note T here goes from minus infinity to infinity. And when T is minus infinity, this whole thing is zero. Okay? So the metric is singular at T equals minus infinity, right? The determinant vanishes at that point. It's not invertible anymore. And if you think about what T equals minus infinity means, T equals minus infinity, this goes away, this goes away. The sinh gives you minus the e to the minus t, right? So the sinh, this is blowing up. This is blowing up with a plus. So that surface is actually x naught plus x4 equals 0, and xi equals 0. Okay, so x4 plus x naught plus x4 equals 0 is this line, right? This line here is x naught plus x4 equals 0. So what happens is that the flat slicing goes singular on this surface. In other words, it only, and if you think it through, the flat slicing only covers half of the space-time. There's a contracting half, and there's an expanding half. And one coordinate system like this only covers one of those two pieces. Okay? So it only covers half of the space-time. But what's interesting about the flat space-time in our universe is that if you ask, what is the time slicing defined by the matter? Okay, the matter has some density in the universe, the ordinary matter, the stars, the galaxies, and so on. And if I slice the space-time on a surface of constant matter density, those surfaces are flat. And so the best approximation to our universe is actually this flat slicing. And again, that's an interesting puzzle as to why it is that the matter lies on flat spatial slices of the universe. Yeah?
So that expression seems to have an exponential scale factor.
Right.
Is that similar to the inflation?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So the idea of inflation is precisely that the very early universe looked like this, okay? Where the length scale during inflation was tiny, okay? So you want a length, inflation, you want a tiny patch of the universe to blow up exponentially, and then it fills with radiation. The inflationary energy fills, gets converted into radiation. The dark energy in the inflation epoch converts into radiation and matter, and then it expands further, and so and then finally the current dark energy dominates. So De Sitter space. So both in inflationary cosmology. According to the very early universe, was a version of De Sitter space-time. L very small, Okay, so roughly speaking, you can think about inflation being the theory that a tiny little universe with very small l expanded exponentially, okay? And then this created matter and radiation, and then finally, and the very late universe is 2, L very large. Okay, so inflation is basically a theory that there were these two phases that looked to sit alike. Okay, now as you may know, I'm not a huge fan of inflationary theory. I think a lot is swept under the rug in that theory, but it's still a very interesting idea. Yep.
So you have a parametrization of your surface like this, mm-hmm. and then you make a parametrization like that.
Yes.
So how do you?
Oh yes, sorry. I should have emphasized that. But these equations I wrote down guarantee that that quadratic equation is solved.
Right.
Yeah.
So then how do you identify if you're making a space-like slicing or a time-like slicing? Just by looking at the coordinates.
Yes. So if I stare at, you see, I can see that afterwards. Where did I write the closed slicing? Here. You see, in the closed slicing, slicing means constant t. Okay? So constant t, x naught is fixed. Right? If I fix t, x naught is fixed. So that tells me the closed slicing is just slicing a constant x naught. The constant time surfaces are constant x naught surfaces. If I go to this slicing, at constant t, you can see that x naught plus x4 equals, so add those two things. You know the bad term cancels. These cosh plus sinh is exponential. So this is L e to the t. So constant t means this number, x naught plus x4, is increasing. And those curves, I won't pull it down again, okay? But these curves are constant equals L e to the t. This would be t equals minus infinity, x naught plus x4 is 0, and this curve would be some t, some finite t. And then as we go off, we go to t equals infinity. So you can just see by looking at t equals constant surfaces how you have sliced the spacetime. And then I won't bother writing down the open slicing, but you can find it, for example, in Tony Z's book. And that's also very interesting in some cosmological theories. Let me mention another very curious thing about De Sitter spacetime. Go ahead.
How do we make a link between t and something that we're
going to call time? Okay. I'm just about to do that. Okay. So here is our spacetime metric. Okay. Now, this L I put outside, okay? But so let's define T proper to be LT. Then this becomes minus DT proper squared plus cosh squared T proper over L times d omega 3 squared. Now, on this 3 sphere, I can always pick coordinates so that at any one point it looks like flat space. So let's do that. So imagine this is really just flat space as far as a local person is concerned. This is some scale. It's the radius of the 3 sphere. Okay. So here you see we already have something that looks like Minkowski spacetime at any particular point on the sphere. But you have to bear in mind the space is actually a big sphere. I should have put the L squared there. And this is the radius of the 3 sphere. This is the radius squared of the 3 sphere. Okay, and this is just the flat space metric in, sorry, this is the metric on a three sphere. So TP is the time we would measure using a clock. And so the picture I told you, basically we have this big three-sphere universe that is shrinking and then growing, is what you would see in the closed slicing. I want to point out another curiosity, this just to look ahead a little bit. You may have heard of the Hawking temperature. Have you heard of the Hawking temperature of a black hole or de Sitter space? So de Sitter space, like the dark energy dominated universe, has an effective temperature. And I'll show you, this follows in one line from this formula with a little mathematical trick, okay? So the trick is, say T, the proper time is I times imaginary time, tau. So imagine this proper time is imaginary, okay? And do the substitution, and then we're going to get d tau squared plus L squared cos squared. Cosh with an imaginary argument gives a cosine. T tau over L squared, sorry, tau over L, d omega 3 squared. Now this function, cos squared, is periodic. Yeah, I actually should have done something else as well. Tau minus pi over 2. Okay, make this substitution. Because I don't want a cosine squared here, I want a sine squared. And then this becomes sine squared. And notice that this function is periodic in imaginary time. In fact, this metric is the metric on a four sphere, like the four-dimensional sphere. This is periodic in imaginary time. What's the period? Is equal to 2 pi, sorry, is equal to L over 2 pi. And there is a formal correspondence between temperature and imaginary time, which is the following. You know from the Boltzmann distribution that you have e to the minus h over t, where h is the temperature. You can think about this as being e to the minus I h t, the normal quantum mechanical evolution in time, providing you say t is minus I 1 over temperature. And then in thermal physics, one actually takes a trace. You sum over all states, e to the minus h over t. And that means that you can think about this as time evolution in imaginary time. The trace means it's periodic. This means periodic with period delta tau equals to 1 over the temperature. And so when I find my space-time has a period, L over 2 pi, in imaginary time, this is equal to, I can interpret it as a temperature, and the Hawking temperature is 2 pi over L. And as I mentioned, in de Sitter space-time, this 1 over L really turns into the Hubble constant. And so, did I get my 2 pi's right?
No. 2 pi L. Period.
What's the period is 2 pi L, thank you. 2 pi L. Yep. cosine of, sorry, sine of tau over L has period 2 pi L Q. So this would be 2 pi L. So the temperature is 1 over 2 pi L. And this turns out to be the Hubble constant over 2 pi. And so that's a very, very sketchy derivation, okay? But this correspondence between the real space-time and a space-time where I made time imaginary actually is a very powerful idea and more or less leads directly to the Hawking temperature. If you do the same thing with a black hole, it also works. Take a black hole metric. We'll do that next week. And send the time imaginary, you'll find the imaginary time version of the black hole is actually periodic in imaginary time. Okay, that was a digression. Let me get back to where I should be. So we've discussed De Sitter spacetime as an example of spacetime that is easily embeddable inside a flat spacetime of higher dimension. But let's go back to more general spacetimes, and in particular to the idea of differentiation. Now, I think David introduced this idea of differentiating on a curved spacetime, on a spacetime with a general metric, g mu nu. And to differentiate, you need a certain extra quantity called a connection. And basically, the point is that the laws of physics are always expressed, all the ones we know, are expressed as differential equations. You have to be able to compare things at different spacetime points if you're going to construct a derivative. And the way you but if you do the naive thing and just take a partial derivative, this fails to be a tensor. It doesn't transform properly. And so you should not express the laws of physics in terms of ordinary partial derivatives. You need to correct them with a quantity called a connection. So the laws of physics are expressed using derivatives. But the ordinary partial derivatives of tensors, let's say of vectors or tensors, or more generally, tensors are not tensors. So you need to correct them using a connection. So the connection is literally the way you compare some quantity at two neighboring points in order to construct a derivative. So first of all, let me give you the definition of, first of all, let me just show you that the ordinary partial derivatives of a vector are not, doesn't build a tensor, okay? So I've got some vector. And remember, the transformation law is that it is this. Okay, a vector by definition transforms according to this formula. But now, if I consider the derivative of v, so consider dv mu dx alpha with everything primed. Okay, and as I mentioned before, just be careful that when I have this as a function of all the x's, this is not really an index on the quantity. It just means, it's just to remind you that there are really four of these quantities and it's functions of all of them. In fact, I'll get rid of that index so it doesn't confuse you, but that x prime there really means the quantity is a function of all four x primes. So let's compute this quantity. Well, d by dx prime is just dx by dx prime alpha d by dx lambda. Okay, so the derivative transforms like a tensor. The vector transformed like a tensor. So just plug in that the first equation, and I've got dx prime mu dx beta v beta. Okay, and so what I get is two terms. First of all, differentiating the vector, I get the good term dx prime alpha dv beta dx lambda. Dx prime mu dx beta. Now that's the correct term because I get one transformation index. Sorry, what is this index? That shouldn't have been it. That should be a lambda. Okay, so this transformation index acts on the lower index. That's correct. This transformation matrix acts on the upper matrix. So that term is correct. But I also get the second derivative of my x prime transformation. So I get dx lambda dx prime alpha d2x prime mu dx lambda dx beta v beta. Okay? So that is good. This is the right formula for a tensor with one up and one down index, okay, which I write as 1, 1, a tensor form 1, 1, tensor with one up and one down index. But this is wrong. For a 1, 1 tensor. Okay? So the purpose of the connection is to get rid of that term. Because that term indicates you don't have a tensor at all. And if you write down any equations involving such a quantity, they will not transform properly from one coordinate system to another. So what Riemann did in 1830 was to figure out how to correct that and define a derivative which really gave a tensor. So Riemann said, let's consider some quantity gamma mu nu alpha, gamma mu nu alpha of x, such that it transforms, this is primed of x primed. So the transformation law of gamma will be the normal tensor transformation, dx prime dx for all the upper indices, and dx dx prime for the lower indices, gamma. Okay, so here we have rho beta gamma, rho beta gamma, mu nu alpha. Okay, so that would be the normal transformation for a tensor. But you've got to add this second derivative term, mu dx lambda, d2x lambda, dx nu prime, dx prime alpha. OK, so gamma, by definition, is not a tensor. OK, not a tensor. And if you do that, then then you can make a derivative called a covariant derivative. So instead of writing partial d by dx mu or d mu, I instead write this covariant derivative. It's called a covariant derivative. And it's equal to the ordinary derivative dv nu dx mu plus gamma nu mu alpha v alpha. Then this quantity is a 1-1 tensor. OK, so so, yeah. No, there should be a plus sign. And if you ask, how did it manage to cancel this guy? It manages to cancel because of the following identity. So I'll leave this to you to show using. OK, now let me just. You see, the point is, in this formula, I've got d2x dx prime squared, right? In this formula, I've got dx prime dx, right? Those are different. Yes, they invert. OK, so I'll show you part of the proof. So we've got dx. You see, remember that dx dx prime mu, dx prime mu dx beta, well, that's equal to dx alpha dx beta, which is delta alpha beta. We've got this identity. This identity relates the dx dx prime to the dx prime dx. Now, differentiate this guy. I'm going to get d2x dx prime dx prime. OK? Times dx prime dx. So if I take this formula and apply d by dx to it, d by dx is d by dx prime times dx prime dx. So I'm going to get that from the first term. And the second term, I'm going to get plus dx dx prime. And then here, d2x prime dx dx. And so, and this differentiating the right-hand side gives 0. OK? So basically, second derivatives of x with respect to x prime gives me minus second derivatives of x prime with respect to x. And I'll just leave it to you to fill in on all the indices, OK? And check that this term cancels with this term. OK. I can go through that next time if you want me to, but I'd prefer you to do it. So, So this sounds a bit of a kludge, right? It didn't work, so I just introduced something to make it work. Okay. And at this point, it is pretty much a kludge. But we're going to fix the gamma soon with some physical assumption. But similarly, I can take the covariant derivative of a lowered, of a vector with a lowered index. And this is defined to be the ordinary derivative, v beta, minus gamma. So now I do use minus beta alpha v alpha. And notice the minus choice here. And that's exactly for the reason you mentioned, somebody mentioned. Forgot who. You mentioned, right? Was it you? It was you, right. So when you do the transformation of this guy, you're going to find the dx, dx prime, or whatever, the opposite way around. And that now has the same sign. And so you have to put the gammas with the minus sign to cancel it. Notice a few things about these formulae. Notice I always put the derivative index last. Okay, so this is the derivative index. I always put it last. And basically, this is a little bit pedantic, but it's important when you come to a quantity called torsion, which we're going to discuss shortly. So that's a good convention to follow. Always put the derivative index last. And then basically, you have to contract these indices in the way you have to contract them. Okay, I've got to get something with the downstairs mu. I have a vector with a downstairs index, so I have to contract it with the upstairs guy, and the other index is downstairs. And for a general tensor, let's say I've got some tensor mu, nu, dot, 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 alpha, beta, dot, 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 some upstairs, some downstairs indices. Okay, then the covariant derivative, lambda, of such an object, you can probably guess what it's going to be. So go ahead and guess. Alpha, beta. Anybody got a guess? How am I going to put the gammas in? I'm going to put gamma. Let's put m of these upstairs and n of these downstairs. And I'm going to have m terms here. And I'm going to have n terms here. So gamma t. And I'm going to have gamma t. And how am I going to do them? So it's plus for every upstairs index and minus for every downstairs index. Okay? And just regard the indices as if each term was a vector. Okay, with either up or down. So that's the general rule for differentiating tensors, and it gives you back a tensor. Now, the principle, we're going to determine the connection gamma by making two assumptions. And the assumptions we're going to make are the simplest assumptions. So I'll try and justify them. But they may be wrong. Nevertheless, so far, there's no evidence they're wrong, but nevertheless, it's important to emphasize they are assumptions. So we can fix gamma lambda mu nu by making two simplifying assumptions. So, note, even though gamma isn't a tensor, but if I take the antisymmetric part of gamma, if I take gamma nu mu alpha, and I antisymmetrize, that means 1/2 gamma nu mu alpha minus gamma nu alpha mu. Okay, that actually is a tensor. Is a tensor called the torsion T mu, T nu mu alpha. To see it's a tensor, just look at the transformation law for gamma. You see, if I take the gamma with downstairs nu alpha and I subtract with downstairs alpha nu, the last term is going to cancel because d2x dx prime dx prime will be symmetric on those on the nu and the alpha. Okay, so actually this is a tensor. And so the first assumption we can impose T mu nu alpha T nu mu alpha equals zero. So let's just assume the torsion is zero. It's a tensor, right? So I've written down an equation which is a tensor. So if it's true in one coordinate system, it's true in all coordinate systems. That's good. But it's a simplifying assumption, i.e., zero, torsion is zero. In fact, when you study general theories of gravity, such as supergravity, it turns out the torsion is not zero. Okay? The torsion follows from the equation of motion of the Lagrangian, and it turns out it's not zero. But it turns out it's small. The torsion, in fact, in supergravity is proportional to the density of spin. Okay, so if you have some matter and it just happens that all the spins are basically correlated, you can build up a source for torsion. And spins are not very correlated, and in the real world, and so far nobody's ever measured the torsion. It's still a very interesting question to try to measure it, but as a simplifying assumption, we're allowed to just set it zero. If you set it zero, that's the assumption, equivalent to the assumption, that this connection is symmetric, right? So that implies, completely equivalent to the assumption, that gamma nu mu alpha equals gamma nu alpha mu. Okay, so that's the first assumption. The second one is we can consider the following tensor, which is the covariant derivative of the metric itself. Yeah?
How can you physically interpret torsion?
Yeah. There are two ways to do it. Probably it'll be easier after the next lecture, but let me tell you in words and maybe give you an equation for it next lecture. So in words, what happens is imagine I'm sitting at some space-time point, and I have two vectors. Let's say some vector u mu. So you can think about that as, you can think about a vector as if it was the tangent vector to a curve. Okay, a curve would be x mu of lambda. This is the parameter. And I can differentiate this d lambda. This is now a vector. And And I can set it equal to u mu at a point. And so basically, you can imagine through every point a set of curves. And the tangent, you can imagine a collection of curves. The tangent vector to a particular curve through that point is a vector at the point. Okay, so that's a good notion. Now imagine some other curve with its own tangent vector, v mu. Okay, so two curves through a space-time point, the same space-time point, both of them with a vector on them. Now what I can do is transport this vector, the u, a little bit along the vector v. So imagine this particle carries some vector, could be like the spin of the particle, carry it along the vector v, some distance. Okay, so let's call that u mu, twiddle. Okay, so I literally take the vector, imagine the particle's carrying the spin with it, and as it goes, and I ask, okay, what's the spin when it reaches this point along v? Then I'll do the same along this guy. So I imagine there was another particle at the same point with a different spin, and that traveled this way. Okay? And then it turns out that the condition for the torsion to be zero is those two arrows agree. If, so in other words, let's transport the particle first along the vector u mu, some distance, then along the vector v mu, some distance, or do it the other way around. And these two things will agree if the torsion equals zero. So that's a condition for vanishing torsion. Now it's up to you to decide if you like that or if you don't like that. It's completely your choice. So as I said, in theories like supergravity, the torsion's not really a free function. It's fixed in terms of the density of matter, and particularly the spin density, and it's not zero. So it would be very interesting to try to measure it. So far, nobody's ever detected it. And the predicted strength of the torsion in a typical theory is absolutely minute. So we don't know. Yeah. We don't know if there's torsion or not in nature. OK, so that's one assumption, is that the torsion is zero. And you'll see lots of books sort of slide over this, because it's a bit of an embarrassment. And so I think Carroll doesn't even discuss, really just sort of declares, obviously the torsion is zero. Okay. But it's not at all obvious that it's zero. You see, if I did anything else, if I allowed it to float around, what I need is an equation to fix it. Okay, and so, you know, there's a whole other step of work that has to be done to determine the torsion if you want to leave it there. So Einstein chose the simplest option, which is just to assume it's not there. But like I said, there's no really compelling physical reason why the torsion should be zero. There's another condition, in fact, a more mathematical condition, but you can easily see that if I insist that covariant derivatives of a scalar commute, right? So this is another condition which is equivalent to vanishing torsion. If this is true, right, then you can easily show that this implies, for all phi, well, then this implies that the torsion is zero. But again, why should we insist on that? So if covariant derivatives commute on scalars, that's equivalent to the torsion being zero. You can sort of see that because maybe I should spell it out a little bit more. The covariant derivative on a scalar, well, scalar hasn't got any indices, right? So there are no gammas. So in fact, the covariant derivative on a scalar is the ordinary derivative on a scalar. Okay, there are no gammas. This is already a vector. That's a 0, 1 vector, transforms properly. But if I take a second derivative, right, now I have to do this. Well, that's equal to partial d mu d nu phi minus gamma mu alpha d alpha phi nu. Right? And so now I can just see directly that if I impose this condition, right, that this is true. This is symmetrical under mu and nu. But this one is only symmetrical under mu and nu if the torsion is zero. Okay, so you might want to impose this condition. That would be equivalent to torsion being zero. In fact, what we're going to see in the next lecture is that when we compute the commutator of derivatives on a vector, right? Does anyone know what that is? That's the Riemann tensor, okay? And we definitely don't want to set the Riemann tensor to be zero, because if we set the Riemann tensor to zero, we're in flat space. There's a theorem that if the Riemann tensor is zero, you must be in flat space. So we don't want to do that, because we want to curve space-time. So we might adopt this condition, then you'd say, well, why didn't you do the same for vectors? Okay. But this is the way that GR is constructed, that partial derivatives on a scalar commute, but not on a vector. Okay, so that was the first assumption. The second assumption is having this derivative, well, the most obvious thing we can use it for is to take the derivative of the metric, okay? Because the metric was our basic tensor. Our most basic tensor on the space-time was the metric. So take the derivative. Well, that's a tensor, okay? That's a good tensor. And so what am I going to do with it? So let's set it equal to zero, okay? So this is a tensor. This is a 0, 3 tensor. It's three lower indices. So what is it given by? Well, let's set it 0. Okay, this is called, this quantity, d alpha g mu nu, is called the metricity. Okay, and the usual assumption in general relativity is that the metricity is zero. But some people question that. In fact, some people at Perimeter question that. And you may be aware that last couple of years there were several papers by people here, including Laurent Friedel and Lee Smolin, investigating the assumption of non-zero metricity. And it has some pretty dramatic consequences. But all I would want to say is that if it's not zero, you need an equation to determine it. Okay, it's a tensor, and it's there, right? If it's not zero, you need an equation to determine it. So the simplest approach is to set everything zero that you don't actually need. Okay, and that's the starting assumption of GR. So let's see the consequence of this. So if d alpha g mu nu equals zero, and the torsion is zero, then g mu nu, then the connection is given by 1/2 g mu lambda g alpha lambda beta plus g beta lambda alpha minus g alpha beta lambda. Okay, so let's prove that. And this quantity expressed in terms of the metric is called the Christoffel symbol. Okay, so let's prove that. It's not difficult. Proof. D alpha, and I'm going to do it with indices beta gamma. So this has two lowered indices, so I've got to put in two connections, gamma delta, just write them down first, minus gamma g delta, the delta first is on the first index, and then it's on the second index. The derivative index is always last. In this case, we left the gamma index alone. In this case, we left the beta index alone. And then here we have to have the beta, and here we have the gamma. Okay, so the first equation is that this equals zero by assumption. Now let's add cycles. Okay, so cycles just means cycle the indices around, and you get d gamma g alpha beta minus, and then I'm going to cycle once more d beta g gamma alpha. And over here, we're going to cycle again. So alpha goes, let me write all these things down, delta g delta delta, delta minus gamma delta minus gamma delta g delta. OK, so alpha goes to gamma, and beta goes to alpha, and alpha goes to beta, and beta goes to gamma. And over here, alpha goes to gamma, and gamma goes to beta, and beta goes to alpha. And in the last one, alpha goes to beta, and beta goes to gamma, and gamma goes to alpha. Okay, so this is often a useful trick in GR. When you've got an equation you want to use it, try writing it down with the indices cycled. Okay? Sounds like a trivial thing to do, but now you see something very nice happens. This term with gamma alpha gamma is the same as that term, except I left off the beta here, delta beta. And this should be delta, gamma went to beta, gamma went to alpha. Yep. OK, so this term, let me do it in colored chalk. This term is the same as that term if gamma is symmetric, right? Because all that happened between this and that is the indices got changed. OK, so actually, I can cancel these two terms, right? If I subtract this equation from that equation. Now, what about this term? Well, this one is the same as that one, right? With the indices reversed on the gamma. So again, these two will cancel if I subtract this equation from that equation. And so what you can see from this is that but you see, that's great, because now I've canceled four of these things, and the remaining gammas are actually the same thing if it's symmetric. And so I've solved for this gamma in terms of the derivatives of g. So if I form d alpha g beta gamma plus the last equation d beta g gamma alpha minus the second equation, d gamma g alpha beta. Okay, then I've got minus gamma delta gamma alpha g beta delta. And from the last equation, minus the same thing, because this one and this one are identical if gamma is symmetric. So all I get is 2. Okay, so using the symmetry of gamma, all of that equals 0. And so that gives you this result. Gamma delta gamma alpha. So now what I do is, so I've got to get rid of this g. So I just multiply with an inverse g acting on the beta index. So we're going to multiply this with a g beta nu. Okay. And what that will do is convert this g into a delta nu. So I'm going to get a gamma nu gamma alpha equals 1/2. And then I've got g nu beta, this g acting on these guys, d alpha g beta gamma plus d beta g gamma alpha minus d gamma g alpha beta. And that's it, which is what I wanted to prove. Okay, any questions? So if torsion is 0 and if metricity is 0, then the connection is this Christoffel symbol. Now that's actually really nice, because remember, what did I show you about a metric? We could always set the metric eta to equal to eta at a point. The metric could be flat spacetime at a point. And what did I show you about the first derivatives of the metric? You can make them 0 too, okay? So actually, because the connection under these assumptions, because under these assumptions, the connection only depends on the first derivatives of the metric, okay, that means you can set the connection equal to 0 at any space-time point. We can set gamma nu gamma alpha equals 0 at any space-time point. Through a coordinate transformation. Okay? If I had torsion, that would not be true, because torsion is a tensor. If it's not 0, I can't do anything with a coordinate transformation to make it 0. That would be an inconsistency. So if a tensor is 0 in one coordinate system, it must be 0 in all coordinate systems. And if it's non-zero in one coordinate system, it must be non-zero in all coordinate systems. Okay? So this assumption of torsion being 0 has a very nice consequence, which is that actually this connection can be set 0. So derivatives become ordinary derivatives in the appropriate coordinate system at any flat space-time point. So again, this sort of justifies, after the fact, justifies the assumption of zero torsion. Yeah?
I'm a little confused where you put the indices under Christoffel symbol in the equation with minus 2 gamma.
Sorry, here?
Yeah, I think should the indices on the gamma be beta alpha or alpha beta?
Sorry, here?
Yeah, I think you put gamma and beta.
Oh, sorry. How did I get a gamma? I took this term. And this term, right? Yeah, you're right. That should be beta alpha gamma delta. Thank you. Do they agree now? Yes. Okay, thanks a lot. And I guess this means here, this is alpha beta. Thanks. Yeah, so the indices now agree. They should agree. They don't. I've got this wrong too. So, of course, I want to get rid of this guy. Sorry. So I multiply by g gamma nu, right? And that converts this delta. So this together becomes a delta nu delta. So that converts this to a nu. And now I've got to have beta blah, blah, blah. I've got gamma nu. Yeah, I just contract with the gamma, sorry. I've got nu gamma. Let me just check if that's right. Yeah, that's correct. Okay, thanks. So hopefully all the indices are right now. Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah. Is there anything? Well, again, you see, if the metricity was not zero, if the metricity is not zero, then you have some surprising consequences, okay? So imagine I've got a vector. Imagine I've got some vector whose covariant derivative is zero. Okay, so this is the nearest thing you can get to a constant vector on a curved space, right? Its covariant derivative is zero. So this is roughly speaking that the vector is constant. Okay, however, form the length of that vector. Let me put the index up. Doesn't really matter, but let me put the index up. This means you've got a constant vector on the spacetime. There's no other way of imposing that the vector be constant. Well, the length of the vector, the length squared of this vector, is g mu nu v mu v nu, right? That's the only thing I can write down that is a scalar number, something without any indices using the metric. But if the metricity is not zero, okay, then the ordinary derivative, so this is a scalar, right? No indices. So this is my phi. And so covariant derivative of this guy is just ordinary derivative. Okay, so d alpha of phi is d by dx alpha of phi, g mu nu v mu v nu. Okay, so that's a good tensor, the derivative of the length squared of the vector. Now, of course, this I can write as d alpha covariant of g mu nu v mu v nu. And something I didn't, manual, front. Something I didn't emphasize, but which is true, is that the covariant derivative satisfies the rule that if you differentiate a product, you get, what's that rule?
Leibniz
rule. Okay, sorry, I never remember names. So this covariant derivative satisfies the following rule, the d alpha g mu nu times v mu v nu plus g mu nu d alpha v mu v nu. So this is Leibniz. Plus g mu nu v mu d alpha v nu, okay? Covariant derivatives satisfy the Leibniz rule. The way they satisfy it, if you take the general formula with the plus gammas and minus gammas on the upstairs and downstairs indices, if you contract two of those indices, the plus and the minus cancel. One gamma cancels. So a covariant derivative on a scalar is actually the ordinary derivative. And that's because basically the gammas in these downstairs guys and upstairs guys all cancel. Okay? But nevertheless, I can write it this way. This is a valid formula. It just means when I wrote this down, I would have two gammas with minus signs. And here I'd have one gamma with a plus sign. Here I have one gamma with a plus sign. They actually cancel, but this is still a valid formula. Now, by assumption, this was zero, right? By assumption. This is a matricity. Okay. If the matricity is not zero, then the length squared of a vector that is constant, the length squared is not constant due to the matricity. So it's kind of messing up your whole notion of what it means to measure lengths. Okay. So if the vector is constant, the length squared is not constant if the matricity is not zero. Okay, so if you would like a notion, you know, to keep things as simple as possible, that things which are constant don't change their lengths on you, then matricity is a good assumption. But it's an assumption. Any other questions? Okay, I think you need a break.